Hi, everybody. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and this is Holding Court. All right, so a Tennis Tuesday here on Holding Court, and nobody better to talk to about issues surrounding the game of tennis than my good old buddy Peter Botta, one of the great tennis authors, journalists for many, many years. Maybe, Pete, at the top of the list, of course, writing both of my books with me, Tennis for Dummies, which, of course, was huge, as we know, and my own book, Hardcourt Confidential. So we spent many hours together. I appreciate all you've done for me, Pete, and all you continue to do for tennis with your great writing. And the reason I wanted you specifically on today was I just read your piece this morning on Naomi Osaka and what happened out in the desert in California. First of all, how are you? And thanks for... I can't believe I haven't had you on Holding Court. That doesn't make any sense at all to me. So good to have you.
Yeah, save the best for last, right? It's great to hear from you. Those accolades are probably not entirely warranted and justified, but I really appreciate them. And as you know, we just had a great time every minute of the projects we've worked on together. And more than that, I think we kind of have it in some fundamental ways a similar view of the world, a little bit of skepticism thrown in there, open-mindedness. And so it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, so the article on Osaka came out on tennis.com. You've been writing for them for a long time. You wrote for ESPN.com for quite a while as well. But sort of summarize for the listeners out there, sort of your take on what happened. Of course, Osaka, for those of you who don't know, was heckled by someone in the crowd early in her match. Someone said, "I believe Osaka, you suck," is what they said. She reacted to that in a way that we've really never seen before in a tennis court, Pete. She just sort of, couldn't get it out of her head, and actually at a couple times in the match wanted to speak to the crowd in the middle of the match. So let's get to you, because I think your piece really summarized and talked about some of the issues surrounding what happened out there in California.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and there are two levels to this. There's the macro level of Osaka and her long-term career and her history, and there's a micro level of what happened in this particular incident. And of course, there's a great linkage between the two of them. But I want to go back for a second. When you mentioned that the fan shouted out, "Osaka, you suck," I actually had originally written that in quotes too, having read what I did. Then I went back to fact check my column, and I saw that the fan had actually asked Naomi, "You suck."
Okay.
Now,
okay.
It doesn't sound like much of a distinction, but it sort of tells me that this was really a tennis person. Mm-hmm. And that, because, how tennis, even the commentators, it's not Muguruza, it's Mugu this, it's not Madison Keys, it's Maddie, there's all these kinds
of
different...
That drives me crazy, by the way, when commentators... Yeah, it drives me absolutely crazy when they said their nicknames on television. I don't like that at all. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead. I try not to do that. If I ever do that, I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years. So if I don't think I do that, if I ever have, I hit myself on the side, for doing it.
You got to go where your thoughts take you. I agree 100%. So it's good. It should be a conversation. It's not a checklist. So we're good on that. But yes, I think that indicated very much that, there's a person who knows her tennis and feels intimate. And one of the overlooked things, I think, that I do point this out later in the column, actually, because it sounds a little Philistine almost. But look, tennis fans, people who go to see tennis, they save up money. They spend a lot of money to go and see Naomi Osaka, even in Palm Springs, where it's, obviously it's a very wealthy community in Indian Wells. But, fans expect a certain level of, it's a transactional relationship between tennis players and tennis fans. And in my view, I think, I almost, if I had to create a persona, if I were writing a novel with this as part of a scene in it, I would have this woman be a tennis fan who just came and she's dying to see Osaka. She may not love her, but she wants to see Naomi Osaka. She calls her Naomi. She goes out there. Naomi Osaka gets broken in the first game of the thing. All the stuff she's gone through in the past, the meltdown at the U.S. Open, these other incidents, kicks in. And a woman just yells out, She gets mad and says she's not coming to see a version of Hamlet. She's coming to see a high quality tennis match, and there's a chance that she may not see it. So, I think that would be my take on that kind of a thing.
Now, you fact check, and I think I saw, but you could correct me if I'm wrong, that it happened after the first game. Was that
yes?
That's a little early for, I mean, I'm, you know, for the fan to be assessing that any player sucks, to be doing it after the first game. So, I mean, obviously there's a side of it that heckling is the right of the fan, so to speak, for what you just said, paying their big bucks to get a seat, to get, you know, and obviously both of us are New Yorkers. We've been to plenty of games in Madison Square Garden where you know, things are said a lot worse. Of course, it's a different atmosphere, obviously, at a hockey game or a basketball game. That being said, it did seem that the reaction from Naomi was rather startling.
Yes, and let me be clear, by the way, I don't like heckling. I'm not for it. And this woman, I'm certainly not trying to justify her. I'm just trying to figure out what could have been going on in her head. And I think a lot of Naomi's back history, people are very aware of what she's gone through in, you know, in the past year and a half or so. And I think they have opinions about that. But anyway, I think, you know, and the really sad thing in a sense, and this is where, you know, you kind of, your heart kind of goes out to her, is that she's, as she told the crowd in that curious post-match interview, that you know, she saw images of 2001 and Venus and Serena and that terrible controversy when her father was accused by many people of fixing their matches, and then they Venus didn't play her semi, pulled out right before she's supposed to play Serena's semi, which, and so Serena, the crowd went crazy on Serena at the end of that. And there were, then, you know, there were later on accusations of racism. Richard Williams said he'd been called, terrible racist names and stuff. So, I mean, all that was, that's a big part, unfortunately, of one of the most infamous incidents in tennis. But for that, for Naomi to be triggered and have that happen, it's hard to say that the racial, there's, appeared to be no racial context in, mm-hmm. in what the heckler said. And there certainly wasn't in the crowd react. The crowd actually really supported Naomi the whole way. So something clearly happened in her. I mean, this triggered something that, goes back probably to some degree to her social activism frame of mind, her feelings about race relations, her feelings about herself and her image and how people perceive her. And I think, I think when she asked to address the crowd, it was really telling because she, something weird was happening to her and she wanted to tell people what it was so they don't think she was just being a weenie mm-hmm. and crying and being all wussy. So I think it was really an unfortunate combination of circumstances.
I mean, and obviously we all feel for whatever Naomi Osaka is going through. I mean, she's obviously having a difficult time with her mental health, which is, I've given her credit for pointing that out and bringing that to the forefront, Pete, as she's done in the last year and a half, starting, of course, with not wanting to talk to the press at the French Open. And I didn't like the way the French Tennis Federation and the other majors handled that. But there is also the part of me that says, I mean, you're a professional tennis player. Even when she was going, but even before this incident, when she was going through the press issues, it was like, okay, we hear what you're saying, we respect what you're saying. You got a lot of courage to go out on a limb and put yourself out there and actually withdraw from the French Open. All that being said, it is part of being a professional athlete to speak to the press, even with the world that we now live in of social media, where if you're Naomi Osaka or Serena Williams or Rafael Nadal, you have your own platform. You can speak to your fans anytime you want, which never happened up until the last, 15 years or so. And it's obviously increased in the last 10 years. So, okay, players have that platform. They can do that, but it's still part of being a professional athlete, an entertainer, whatever, a politician, that you must have communicate with the press. So this situation is even weirder to me, Pete, because to ask to speak to the crowd in the middle of the match, of a competitive match in one of the biggest tournaments in the world, I don't believe I've ever seen that happen. The only thing I can think of that's comparable is, Davis Cup matches where things were sort of getting out of control in different places. And as you know, of course, I was a captain of the U.S. team for 10 years. It never happened to me, but I've seen instances where the captain of the home country, when the home country was saying things a lot worse than "you suck" to players, took the mic and said, okay, well, we need to calm down here, to sort of calm the fans down. But I can't remember ever seeing a player actually want to take the mic in the middle of the match. Can you?
You know, I've been combing my memory and I haven't hit anything on the internet yet, but oddly enough, and by the way, it was a great run you had as captain.
Oh, thank you, Pete.
Glory years for the U.S. You know, that was terrific. But, and I seem to recall at one point, Connors, who else, of course, a guy who probably loved being heckled, right? You know, I think at some point he kind of did something, but it wasn't just, I think he climbed up sort of on the umpire's chair a little bit and then said a few words into the mic, and it wasn't anything. This is different. This is a woman wanting her day in court, in a sense. This woman trying, you know, to explain, I think, a very complicated situation that's going on in her head, and she knows she's not going to be able to do it. I mean, nobody's going to understand why she's crying. She's going to think, you know, it was because of what the heckler said, but it probably was really because of these images in her head, and she couldn't get out these images of Serena getting dumped on. I think where she really kind of lost it and lost to some degree some sympathy is where she said, you know, she sort of said, you all should watch it. Well, you know, I think a lot of people saw that. Mm-hmm. And almost everybody I know, it was appalled and mortified. And, you know, I think, you know, she was, I think, took a little too much liberty in assuming that the woman, the heckler's comment was racially based. There was no sign of that particularly. And look, let's be frank. I mean, you know, we're not going to pretend that there's, you know, that everyone's lovey-dovey. There's no such thing as racism. But there was, you know, no evidence, either clear or even obscure, that the comment was racially motivated. So, you know, I don't know. I think that was a little bit a weird place to take that, I think, and not entirely fair in many ways, because, you know, sometimes a heckler is just a heckler. You know, sometimes.
Well, yeah, and apparently the woman was in one of those the high end suites, you know, which are very expensive, drinking. So apparently, so I mean, that was one of the things I was able to dig up. I can't confirm this, but that she was having a few beverages and maybe a few too many. So again, these are the things that happen at sporting events. So I guess we need to take, as you started with this, with our interview here today, Pete, our chat about sort of the macro view, which is, where does Osaka go from here? And by the way, I want to ask you, where does Djokovic go from here again? Because I know you've written a couple of great pieces on that as well. But let's stick with Naomi for a moment, Naomi Osaka. And where does she go from here? Because it seems like, I mean, let's be frank here. I mean, if you can't handle a heckler, now she did say that she's been heckled before, whether that's true or not. I mean, I have no reason not to believe her, but I've certainly never heard her heckled anywhere. And everywhere she's gone to play, she's a huge, you know, she's got huge star power and people love to watch her play. I mean, she's a great player. She's won 4 majors. But what does this mean for her future? Because clearly she has some issues that she's continuing to try to deal with as far as her mental health is concerned.
You know, that gets back to this issue of her that we just talked about, connecting the dots, you know, connecting the dots from being heckled to the fact that it's racist, to the fact that she's in Palm Springs, and this is what happened to Serena after that controversial ending to that tournament. So you kind of understand how that might have happened. You know, where she goes from here is a very, very good question, because I think one of the, you know, themes in the story, and I think one of the lasting macro issues here is, look, and I think to some degree, I'm not so big on accusing her of entitlement entirely, but I think one of the things is she kind of wants to have things on her terms, even something like addressing the crowd. You know, I mean, just to think that she would be able to get that because she's right. Naomi Osaka, mm-hmm. big tennis star, it's quite a leap, mental leap for someone. And I think, you know, I started my piece with using a headline from the New York Times before she came back from to the Olympics, and it says she's coming back on her own terms. Well, you know, her own terms haven't worked out that well for her. You know, I mean, her own terms was not doing press and then finding out that the players didn't really support her. The tournaments didn't roll over. However one feels about how they handle that, you know, at the end of the day, the fact is she ended up, I think, saving face. And that's really why she came out with her, that very moving, touching confession of the problems she's had, her mental health issues, the depression, the anxiety. So, but she didn't really do that. You know, when she actually, you know, asked to be excused from the press conferences and stuff, there was no mention of that. She just talked about what idiots the reporters were and how boring it was and what a pain it was. And there's some truth in that, of course, as we know. But
I would never accuse you, Pete Bodo, of being boring, by the way.
I had my moments, but you know, it's a collegial relationship for most players. It's just a little bit of a pain for them actually after they shower up and get a massage to come over and meet with the press, but they're generally great. So, I mean, I think her attempts to impose to sort of, I think what she's trying to do is create a boutique tennis experience for herself. And it just doesn't work that way. People are not going to, you know, sort of say, well, you know, okay, Naomi needs this. She wants this. She doesn't really like this because she's very sensitive. And right. You can't do that. I mean, that's going to be coming back on anything she wanted to do on her own terms. A lot of it just hasn't, even coming back to tennis aspect of coming back on her terms, meaning taking 3 months off and coming back. That's not working out either.
Right.
And by the way, he's got 21 open.
Right. And by the way, it's fine to be sensitive. I mean, you know, all of us are sensitive in our own ways, and good for you and good for anybody for being able to talk about it and be honest about it. But at the same time, as a professional in whatever profession you're doing, you have certain responsibilities. One of them, clearly is speaking to the press. And I have to say, you know, when she took her first sabbatical and maybe it was, you know, she made too big a deal about not wanting to talk to the press. But for someone that doesn't want to talk to the press after a match, she's sure doing a lot of press.
Exactly.
Like you said, you know, what triggered me is when you said on her terms. I mean, and I'm all for any tennis player making as much money as they possibly can, because we know that most tennis players struggle to make a real living out on the tour. I'm not talking about the Serenas and Rogers and Rafas and Naomis. Okay, they make a fortune. They deserve it. They should make it. But you know, I have to say that every time I saw Naomi do another commercial or another ad, I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, you know, that had to be set up. Her agent had to set that up. That had to be a photo shoot. She had to, you know, meet with press. She had to get her hair done. All these things that have to happen. And there's a lot of those things for have to happen. And we see Serena, you know, she's found like an amazing, I'm going to call it post tennis, because I don't know if she's going to, I mean, she says she wants to play more, but you know, God bless her for what she's been able to do with her off the court stuff. I think it's great. Roger Federer is one of the most, you know, well-paid athletes on the planet because of what he's been able to do. So it's hard when you're kind of using that card that Naomi did, and then you're out there sort of all over the place on billboards and making the money doing, you know, big PR stuff that she's doing. And again, she has absolutely earned that right, and she's got the charisma and the game to be able to back it up. So as I said, more power to you. But you know, I'm not going to say respect, but it rankles me just a little bit, I guess is what I'm getting at, without trying to be politically incorrect here. I don't want to take a shot at her because I don't think she deserves it, because I feel for her. That's the most important thing to me, is I feel bad for her. But at the same time, you got to be able to understand what you're dealing with as being a superstar tennis player.
Yeah, look, it's kind of about having it both ways. And I think it's very hard to have it both ways. I mean, I think I agree 100%. I mean, I think a lot of people, and this is, you know, again, why somebody like this crazy heckler could be driven to yell something stupid like that, is that, you know, they see that, well, you know, she's talking about how shy she is, and she's, you know, saying, you know, that she's very sensitive and she wants her space and her time. And then, as you say, she's doing all these things, all of which are public facing. So, you know, it's a little like, well, you know, how could you be that comfortable doing all these interviews and stuff, but you can't do the simple ones that you're asked for in tennis. So I think there's a lot going on there. I mean, I think of her, and also I think some of the other players, they actually do spend, they do speak out about things and stuff. And maybe this is a segue to Djokovic here, but out of all the players, only Djokovic, in my mind, has expressed, you know, some solidarity. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's a little too harsh, but Djokovic's solidarity in his attempts to start this new player union and his buying into the prize money controversy, at least for those of us who are plugged into what's happening in the halls of power, you know, this controversy over the lower ranking players deserving a little bit more money, and maybe the pay structure in tennis is too top heavy and there shouldn't be that big a difference between these rounds, etc. I mean, I haven't heard many of the women players, certainly top women players, or really even that much the men players, you know, take an active role in it, how they feel about their colleagues, you know, and are they actually pushing for a more I don't even want to say fair, but a more, you know, a more broadly engineered distribution of prize money where lower ranked players are making a little bit more than they're making now.
Right,
and the higher ranked players are making a little less.
Yeah, more similar to golf, the way they do it in golf, which I happen to think that's the way it should go. So, all right, let's transition to Djokovic because you wrote a great article after he gave his first sort of interview post-Australia, which was with the BBC. He continues to take the stance that he's not going to be vaccinated. So I know how you feel about that. I know how I feel about that. I think it's absurd. But again, he's got his right just like any other person does. But that doesn't mean then they have the right to, you know, continue to do what they do. I had to get vaccinated to keep my job, as did, you know, millions and millions of other people. Not to mention the fact that, I mean, the main reason I did it, okay, when it first became available here, was to protect the world. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously my family, but, you know, knock on wood, you know, I have young kids and, you know, we're relatively healthy, but I wasn't like running to get the vaccine, Pete, because I'm like, oh my God, this is going to save my life. Okay, I'd already had it. But the reason I did it was like, God, if I do this, if I do my part, you know, maybe we can all get back to some semblance of normalcy, which it finally feels like 2 years later, we're kind of almost there. But it seems to me like Novak Djokovic is just going to wait it out. And he may actually be able to win this battle. You called it the hill he's willing to stand on. And it looks like if, you know, some of these restrictions start to ease up, which they're apparently doing. You know, I went to New York City. Do I need to show my vaccine? Nope, you don't need to show it anymore, you know, to get into a restaurant or wherever you're going. So is that the end game here for Novak Djokovic?
Well, I think it is. And I must say, you were one of the first people I knew, Patrick, who actually got COVID and you were sequestered in your basement.
That's know. Right.
Thankfully, the family wasn't far, just a staircase away, but still.
Exactly.
And it was a wake-up call for me, too. And I've been vaccinated. I totally support vaccination. I think people who are unvaccinated are short-sighted. I think the end game, you're absolutely right. Djokovic may, the thing is, he won't end up, unless you're just, you know, one of these rabid fans who loves Djokovic and anything that is different from Federer and Nadal is going to make him look great, or is going to make love him even more and lionize him. I think, his end game may prove correct, and I got no problem with that. You know, if they lift the rules on vaccination, I mean, I'm not a medical expert. I will presume that they actually have this under control and that he probably isn't a threat really any more than anyone else is. But, you know, I think the rules have to be applied. And I think the thing that really bothered me earlier on, you know, certainly from a human point of view, was the way he pulled some funny stuff. You know, we'll never find a true story of exactly how the whole Australian attempt desire to get into the tournament without being vaccinated played out, but there weren't many good guys. There weren't many heroes in that saga. So, you know, I really thought that was incredibly arrogant and entitled of him, and it really kind of a real low point in his career. Now, I mean, he's showing he's willing to pay the price of not paying, which is a pretty big price. So, you know, if they say he can come in, you know, who am I to stop? I mean, it's not going to happen. But he really took some really, really big chances.
And by the way, there's plenty of people, as my Twitter feed can attest, that are huge Djokovic fans. And no matter what he does, you know, he's the man. So it's almost like he's got this rabid fan base. And, you know, they just think that he's the guy. You know, it's a lot of bit like what's going on in politics in our country, which is, you know, he's willing to stand up to the government and, you know, stand up to this, you know, facade that's a vaccine and this whole pandemic. Like, people don't believe it's real. It's just crazy. I mean, it's a completely crazy. But like you said, the one place where I give him credit is like he's willing to do it. I mean, he's willing to go to the end game, which is not playing. And losing his number one ranking as he's done, not playing. Of course, he tried to play Australia, but I don't think he'd. I mean, now we could question, you know, how he got that positive test at just the right moment, and it was well after the deadline, of course. So we can all roll our eyes about that and say, very interesting that he tested positive, you know, just in time, in the nick of time. That, as you said, we may never know the true answer to that. But when it comes to, you know, him going to Australia, I mean, I think he believed, at least at the time, that he was going to be let in with this exemption. Now, it's been pretty clear that, well, he's not getting into the United States, at least at the moment. It may be different by the summertime, by the U.S. Open. And it may be different, as we've heard from the French government and the French health authorities, that he may be able to get into the country to play the French Open. So let's put that aside for a second, because let's focus on something positive, which is Mr. Rafael Nadal, who hasn't lost a match this year. And it's amazing when you see that comeback against Court. He's playing today, so maybe by the time people hear this on Tuesday, he will have lost, but I doubt it, against Dan Evans. But it is amazing, Pete, when you see what Rafa's been able to do this first quarter of the year, and I don't think anyone, including him, would have predicted it when he was on crutches about 5 months ago.
Well, look, do you believe in karma? If you believe in karma, then you look at this guy and you look at how everything, unlike Djokovic, in fact, the opposite of Djokovic, everything the guy said and did during the pandemic from the earliest days on was spot on, absolutely considerate, absolutely putting the, you know, world health crisis at the top of his menu. And, you know, the guy's been great. I mean, and he's just a wonderful human being, it seems, at least in this narrow sense. And so I think, you know, there's such a thing as karma. And I think, you know, it's kind of really helped him, you know, navigate all this stuff. And he's steered clear of the controversies. I think, you know, the foot thing, of course, is going to be a real potential problem. It's an ongoing problem, obviously. And something, it's amazing, isn't it? He's got some kind of a foot injury that nobody knows, and he won't say, I guess, exactly what it is. Tell me if you do know. And yet, you know, they haven't been able to do any surgery.
I don't know, except it's some sort of deformity in the foot. But that, and I know they can't.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. They can't operate on it.
Yeah, they can't operate. They can't really. Rehab doesn't seem to work. The only thing he can do is, you know, moderate, I guess, how much competition he engages in. And for him to be able to do that, and be able to not practice as much as he normally would and work as hard as he normally would, I think would, you know, for him in the past, that's been a problem. We even saw, you know, what was it when he lost to Djokovic? He got crushed by Djokovic in the Australian Open final,
right,
after a comeback from that injury, I think, 2 years ago. And, you know, he said, look, I wasn't able to prepare properly. And my defensive skills, which I really, you know, rely on a lot with Novak, just, you know, I didn't have a chance to work on the defense. And my offense was great to get me through these other matches earlier. Now, when I came up to Djokovic, I realized, you know what? Now I know the price I paid for being off for so long. And you know, so I think he had a really realistic appraisal of that situation. To see him now, you know, I don't know if he's adjusted. Like, I mean, clearly he's adjusted because he can't be practicing the same amount, et cetera. Yet the results are better. He's not. He doesn't seem to be as, I guess, upset or as concerned about the impact this stuff is. It's almost a little like he's come to terms with this, and he's not dealing in, well, gee, if only I practiced 3 more hours on Wednesday, you know, I would have won this match in straight sets. I mean, I think he's kind of resigned to saying, look, I'm just going to smell the roses, enjoy my life. I don't owe anybody a dime. Nobody owes me anything. And I'm just going to make the most of my last couple of years and enjoy it. Wonderful to see.
Yeah, and let's remember that he didn't come to the 2020 U.S. Open because of the pandemic. He could have come, but he just didn't feel comfortable coming. So I don't buy this. You know, there's an asterisk next to his Australian Open title this year because Novak couldn't play, which I hear a lot on Twitter from the Djokovic fans, but that's just hogwash. Well, Pete, listen, this has been 30 minutes of enthralling stuff from you. We got to do this more often. I love to have you on. We should do this consistently. We only touched on a couple of topics. We could touch on a lot more, including that we're seeing some life in some of the young American players, which is happening out in Indian Wells as well. So let's stay in touch. Thanks again for doing this on short notice, and keep up the good work. And before I let you go, how's the fishing going? Pete is a big
the fishing,
fisherman.
Just waiting for the water to start warming up a little bit and getting the ice out and getting back up after the steelhead. So yeah, that'll be in April, mid-April. I'm ready to go.
You'll be heading upstate New York as always. All right, the great Pete Bodo here on Holding Court.
Thanks.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.